Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin here with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and I was very encouraged by the number of listeners who wrote in positively about my guest on Monday, and my guest that was Burton Folsom, the author of New Deal or Raw Deal, how FDR's policies left the, left the United States in the trouble we're in today, or destroyed America, or did something. Anyway, New Deal or Raw Deal is the name of the book. And just today, I see a full-page ad from over 200 illustrious members of the Cato Institute. And the Cato Institute is a nonpartisan, very prestigious think tank headquartered in Washington, D.C. And they are all signatories on the page to a comment that was made by President Obama, who said, "There is no disagreement that we need action by our government, a recovery plan that will help to jumpstart the economy." And the comment from these notable eminences is, "With all due respect, Mr. President, that is not true. Notwithstanding reports that all economists are now Keynesians and that we all support a big increase in the burden of government, we, the undersigned, do not believe that more government spending is a way to improve economic performance. More government spending by Hoover and Roosevelt did not pull the United States economy out of the Great Depression in the 1930s. More government spending did not solve Japan's lost decade in the 1990s. As such, it is a triumph of hope over experience to believe that more government spending will help the U.S. today. To improve the economy, policymakers should focus on reforms that remove impediments to work, saving, investment, and production. Lower tax rates and a reduction in the burden of government are the best ways of using fiscal policy to boost growth." Well, Bert, if you're listening, then I'm sure that is music to your ears. For the rest of you, I suggest that you buy Bert's book. I have a feeling that he and I were in some disagreement towards the end of the interview. I don't know that he believes as strongly as I do in the sort of replication of the policies of the 1930s, which look like they're about to take place under the new Obama regime. But one way or the other, it is certain that the policies of free spending are being followed, and it is certain that they failed the first time round. So what this means is for all of you to conclude in your own way, and I hope that we shall hear from Bert again in a few months down the line when he is able to perhaps analyze more fully the results of what is happening right now. Okay, this is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. This is coming to you live from Miami. And as always, you are welcome to ask your questions over the toll-free line provided through the graces and courtesy of Progressive Radio Network for your use. And please call the following number to ask the questions. 888-873-4643. Once more, the number, 888-873-4643. 3-4-6-4-3. Okay, if you would like to email your questions, you can do that too at the following email address. rmartin@latamenv.com. That's LatamInv, meaning Latin American Investments, LatamInv for short. Once more, rmartin@latamenv.com. And then if you would like to call me directly, you can do that too on my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once more, the number 305-579-2012. Okay. Well, I thought that I would talk a little bit today about credit cards. Now, the reason for this is that I got an email a few weeks ago by someone called Josh, entitled "Why Credit Cards Matter So Much." And I thought that because of some news which just came out recently, this was a good time to draw attention to this email, which I will read you. It comes from Josh, and this is what it says. Yesterday put the nail in the coffin of a move from recession to depression. Two pieces of news that were absolutely essential came out, and no, neither one was that we've been in a recession since last year, or that last week's stock market rally was yet another sucker rally. The first was the observation that McDonald's is now the second largest merchant vendor on credit cards. That is, people are now buying their Big Macs on plastic, in part because they don't have the cash. Credit card balances have risen enormously in the last few weeks as people attempt to keep going through the holidays. Commercial bank exposure via the normal amount of credit card loans outstanding has risen more in the last 10 weeks than it did in the previous 10 months combined. Moreover, the growth in the last 10 weeks, $32.3 billion, or roughly $600 million per shopping day, represents nominal growth of 9.3% or 48.3% annualized over the last 10 weeks. According to American Express, delinquencies on credit payments rose to 4.1% of all credit outstanding in the third quarter, up from 2.5% in 2007, with Bank of America's rate rising even more steeply to 5.9% for the period. Moreover, the pool of loans deemed uncollectible rose to a high 6.7% in the third quarter, soaring from 3.6% last September. What consumer spending there is has been fueled in part by credit card. The second largest merchant vendor for credit card use is now McDonald's. This suggests that many consumers are in serious distress if they need to get their $4 Big Mac and fries with a credit card. The second piece of news is the news that credit card companies are planning to pull $2 trillion of personal and small business credit lines over the coming months to reduce their risk. An Oppenheimer & Company analyst noted, the credit card is second key source of consumer liquidity, the first being jobs. In other words, we expect available consumer liquidity in the form of credit card lines to decline by 45%. End of quote. Almost all of the consumer spending we've done in the last few days has been done on credit. In November and December, retailers see more than 40% of their annual sales, and since the average American comes out of the holiday season with more than $800 in credit card debt, it is safe to say that retailers in general are dependent on an annual payback that is then amortized over most of the year in the form of personal credit. That is, the consumer spending economy, 70% of our total economic activity, is utterly dependent on consumer credit. And whether that's a good thing or not, the destruction of consumer credit lines will bring about a shift in consumer spending that makes the personal economic woes look petty. But there is more to it than that. Americans have seen real wages decline and have depended heavily on credit as unemployment rises and companies cut benefits, pensions and retirement savings disappear. They will depend on their credit more, not less. The credit card allows them to even out income streams, and millions of Americans have them. Either they rely on uneven overtime, on tips, on seasonal boom and bust cycles, or as small business owners and contractors whose payment comes in irregularly. When employment strikes, right or wrong, the expenses go on the credit card. When hours are cut back or payouts proposed, the credit card covers the inevitable emergency car repairs or medical bills. Yes, people should have saved. Yes, running up credit card debt you aren't certain you'll be able to pay off is dangerous. But it is also the case that saving has been enormously discouraged and reliance on credit has become a cultural norm, even a cultural pressure. Cards poured out like water. Couples who arrived with a down payment at a mortgage meeting were told to keep their cash and take out a 100% loan. Companies made huge sums of money by persuading ordinary people to put their money in the markets and that growth could never end. Yes, there is personal responsibility here, but the situation was not of each person's personal making, and there is plenty of blame to go around. In difficult times, the American policy is to rely on credit as a reserve source, as a substitute for savings, and that reserve is about to be pulled out from under them. And for the best reasons, the ability to pay is declining rapidly. Most Americans have no idea how they would pay off their debt in this economy, and my bet is that most of them won't. Past recessions have been survived by increasing debt and sitting tight until things got better. Now we can't increase debt, and we can't sit tight, and it'll be a long time before things get better, much longer than most people foresee. You only have to look at the bank's own reasoning here. They're withdrawing their credit lines because they don't believe that a boom will come along and allow people to pay off before they are forced to default. They know that reducing credit on this scale will hurt them too, but their own internal analyses have convinced them that they are in more danger by loaning than they are by not loaning. Given the huge role of consumer credit in the economy, that's one big shift. What is certain is that without credit, the recession will hit a lot harder, a lot faster than it has. Personal spending will drop a whole lot more. People who are getting at least Big Macs will stop having them to eat. Moreover, with reduced credit lines, people will be forced to rapidly assess their situation. The transition between unemployment and foreclosure, between a bad year and homelessness, between getting by and going hungry, between surviving a medical crisis and being bankrupted by it, will be much, much shorter. Yes, building up credit card debt has been bad for us, but it has also functioned to delay our reckoning, to keep marginal participants in the economy going, to keep the economy going even as far as it has been. And without large open credit lines, life as we know it will shift. Suddenly, small businesses won't be able to buy inventory on credit, and many of those businesses will close. Travelers whose balances are near their new, dramatically lowered limit will not travel because they can't reserve a car, a hotel room, or a plane ticket. People will stop shopping online. And the kids whose daily meal, tragically enough, was the Big Mac, and we should remember that one out of every three Americans eats daily in a fast food restaurant, won't eat. Well, thank you for that piece of information, Josh. You know, bankers' worst nightmare is the unemployment rate climbing towards 10%. You know, past data show that a percentage point increase in unemployment leads to roughly a percentage point rise in the charge-off rate, the amount of defaulted loans written off at a loss. But as employment exceeds 9%, bankers think charge-offs will start to increase by more than the increase in unemployment. Why? Because a high rate could cause an unprecedented wave of defaults among prime borrowers who tend to have bigger loan balances. And I quote, "The situation is so extreme and beyond what we've seen in past cycles that management teams are becoming reluctant to predict the relationship between unemployment and credit losses." End of quote. And that comes from Kevin Fitzsimmons, an analyst at Sandler O'Neill and Partners. Watchers have an eye on the next gathering cloud, which is nearly $1 trillion of consumer credit card debt. Americans are relying on these credit cards to an ever-increasing degree. In 2008, the average credit card balance was $11,212, according to CardTrack.com. Compare this to 15 years ago, when the average credit card debt was $4,306. Factors like California's plan to delay income tax refunds and long jobless workers running out their unemployment benefits don't help the situation either. In addition, the banking industry contends that new regulations passed by the Federal Reserve last month will give them no choice but to sharply curtail lending, putting at risk the consumer purchasing power that, as I said, drives 70% of spending in the U.S. What we're seeing is the unwinding of extremely favorable banking regulations towards much tighter lending restrictions. Loose regulations that bankers asked for and received under Bush are now backfiring big time. Well, unfortunately, that's just another nail in the coffin of the economy, and it is about to hit with a vengeance, I fear. All right, let's take some email. Let us start with Steve's rant from last Sunday, and I read, "Richard, when I look back at the Dow Jones charts at the time of the Great Depression and look forward, you really can't see that confidence was ever reestablished. I can't see any lasting increases in volume or huge price increases. From a 1934 Dow of 110 to a 1949 Dow of 160, not a lot of movement over a period of 15 years. What the Dow charts do reflect is the result of the price inflation from the demands of Korea and Vietnam. The Dow was sitting at 950 on 8/15/71 when Nixon unhooked the dollar from gold and set in motion the basic foundation for the position the economy is in today. When paper money is not attached to gold, we leave ourselves open to the folly of politicians. Now, as far as confidence returning to the market, it is my opinion that confidence only came back when all those who were burnt badly in 1929 either retired or died. So when things do get better, it won't be because things have changed much. It will be that all the players are new. Richard, the stock market of the 1920s is nothing like the market post-1971. From 1971 till today, inflation created a demand for stocks and housing so that you could protect the value of your dollar against inflation. Also creating a false demand for stocks are self-directed IRAs and 401ks. So much demand was created by these retirement instruments that corporate stocks were split time and time again as the false demand caused the stock prices to rise. Stock prices rose without any increased value in the underlying company. This is a feeding frenzy or a bubble. Buyer, beware. The talking heads are saying confidence will return soon. I say it'll take 50 years for confidence to return. And it will not really be confidence, just new faces playing an entirely new game, a game played with worthless dollars. Richard, acting on your advice and commentary over the last 2.5 years has saved us a small fortune. Thanks for the wake-up call. Steve Kruger." Well, Steve, thank you very much for that. Pretty much what we've been talking about, and it's nice to see these things being reflected, and quite frankly, I don't mind repeating them over and over again if it seems that it'll do some good. I do find, generally speaking, that those who have been following the wake-up call for a longer period seem to be more psychologically prepared, as one listener put it in an email to me, so for that I am grateful. Now I have an email from Frank Devlin, which I do want to read. I suggested that Frank might want to discuss it himself, and we came to the conclusion that if I read the email, Frank would then come online and discuss it. So Frank, if you are there, you might want to consider ambling over to the phone and dialing the toll-free number, which is 888-873-4643. And also that applies to anyone else who would like to ask a question or make a comment. Once again, the number is 888 877-873-4643. And this is subject of Frank's email. It is yesteryear. Richard, while reading documents and comments, my main source for news, from the automaticearth.blogspot.com, I recalled your description of your first trip to the U.S. in the 60s. It was a different country, and I think a better one. I also heard echoes of Jim Kunstler in this column in relation to our absurd inability to accept the reality of our current condition. Our collective sense of entitlement from bigger houses to bigger cars, coupled with the mantra of perpetual growth, is turning this country into an amusement park for fools. I think our refusal to interact in a rational way within our world is what preceded and abetted the current destructive chain of events, from ludicrous leverage to corrupt governments to fraudulent securities to arrogant securitization, and finally to insane bets on the whole corrupt house of cards. No rational society would have entertained this much folly, nor would they desperately try to perpetuate it. Perhaps we should put a fence around this folly and charge admission as they do at Disneyland. At least that will be an honest buck. John Thane redecorated his office to the tune of $1.2 million, two-thirds of which went to the guy who now reinvents the White House, while Merrill's employers were being handed pink slips. Thane is an obvious idiot, but he is, of course, by no means alone. And the sixth sense of entitlement is not restricted to Wall Street either. It's the norm in circles of bankers and politicians across the planet, which is the reason the Icelandic Prime Minister was forced out today after days, even weeks, of increasingly violent protests. It'll also be the reason for many more governments to tumble this year and next, and more after that. Still, that's the easy part in this. The harder one will come to unfold because of the sense of entitlement that exists all across our societies, that is to say, our own ideas about what we are entitled to. It's not just the bankers who, in Meredith Whitney's words, try to keep their Malibu Barbie houses. Most of those homes belong to people who are not bankers. And there's many Barbie homes outside Malibu. The majority among us live in Barbie houses. We don't just call them that. If we look back, say, 100 years and see the size of our homes and the average living space per capita, we find that while the population of our societies has exploded in the last century, so too has the sense of entitlement we feel concerning the amount of space we want and think we deserve. Vastly more people who all want vastly more space. We can all figure out the trend line here. We are also confident in telling ourselves we have a right to a nice and warm and fast car, an instantly available world-class healthcare, and the best possible education for our children so they can, in time, buy their own Barbie homes and supermarkets full of products flown, shipped, and trucked in from exotic places all over the globe. So, we're not really that different from John Thane, are we? He merely has an even higher entitlement pattern than most of us do, not a structurally different one. I've been critical of Obama's choices for his economic team, and I won't take back one word of that. However, the fiercest criticism should go to his message of getting America back on the track of economic growth. That notion, which is nothing but a fallacy, deserves more scrutiny than any other one. Our economies are shrinking, not growing, and they will continue on down that path for a very long time. Perpetual growth is over, and if you look closely, it has been for at least 30 years. Education, healthcare, and many other fields have become more expensive and less affordable during that time. Who needed daycare in the 1960s? Who could not afford to go to a doctor? Today, both parents need to work full-time or more just to pay the monthly bills. It wasn't like that in the 1960s. Not at all. So were our parents so much less happy than we are? Not at all. The fallacy of perpetual growth has led us into a sense of entitlement that is based on complete blindness and utterly wrong assumptions. If we are not awake enough to leave that behind, we will be the reason for fighting in the streets in our own Barbie neighborhoods. If we want to prevent that from happening, we need to take not one but 826 steps back. But the president of Hope and Belief talks about resuming the economy of growth. That is not possible. People need a reality check. They need to adjust to living on less personal corporate space. If you think or hope that the PM, the Prime Minister of Ireland, is the last one to be thrown out by the wayside, you need to start thinking instead of believing. From the foxhole, Frank. So then Frank sent another email saying, you read it first, and then I'll be happy to talk to you. Maybe some of the listeners might call in. I'll wear a helmet in case I've offended someone. I would like to get to know or at least speak to some of your listeners. Steve Kruger, for one. He makes me laugh, and I shake my head in recognition of his plain-spoken truth that is all too rarely heard nowadays. If any of these ramblings are of value to anybody, I owe that overwhelmingly to your tutelage over the past 2 years. Talk to you on Monday. Thanks, Frank. Well, of course, Monday had to become Thursday because we had our guest on Monday. But indeed, I would urge you, listeners, to call in. Frank is now on the line. And I urge others of you, especially Steve Kruger, with whom Frank would like to communicate and converse, please pick up the phone and call. It would be nice to hear from you. We might be able to spark a little conversation here. We have several lines, so it shouldn't be a problem. And once again, the toll-free number is 888-873-4643. Well, Frank, hi. Nice to know that you are indeed with us.
Do you hear me?
Frank?
Yes, Richard, I'm here.
Oh, hi.
Good to talk to you.
What interests me, you know, in particular about what you wrote is that it seems incredible to me that people, you know, have been sort of knocked for six by the economy and that they're still talking about, you know, taking out loans and the good life and all these things. They don't seem to have much of a sense of criticism towards, you know, their rulers, do they? I mean, they don't seem to understand what's going on. Do you have an explanation for this?
Richard, I don't have one other than the fact that something you just read prior from Steve Kruger, I think, hit a good part of it on the head, that the people who know better are dead
Just one sec. Sorry, Frank, to interrupt you. I just got a message from the engineer. Could you turn off the sound on your computer?
I have done that, Richard.
Understood. Okay.
Steve Kruger just and something he had just sent in mentioned the fact that all the people, the generational effect on this, all the people who knew better. For instance, I remember my parents were very frugal. I know my wife's parents were very frugal. They were both children of the Depression. They're dead, and the people now don't have a memory of it and have no grasp of it. And I think that has led them into a lethargic state where they just go along. And if they understood what was happening, they'd realize that this is silly. If you looked at this from A to Z, we're now madly trying to solve the Z problem, and we haven't even gone back and looked at the A. We're trying to get to a state, as you know, I wrote and the gentleman I quoted wrote, that's unattainable. From a number of reasons, just the energy reasons alone. I was listening to the last portion of Chris Martinson's beautiful economic crash course, and he's finally filled it all in 20 chapters. And one of the ones on energy, he explains that in a normal house, it's equal to having 100 energy slaves, well in good condition, on exercise bikes in the cellar, pedaling their hearts out just to run that house. That doesn't even speak to our cars or our airplanes or any of the machinery we use. We, on per capita, are living better than emperors did centuries ago. And we don't even realize that. And the other thing is that the rest of the world is not living like that. The Chinese aren't living like that. The large portion of them, certainly most of South America, isn't living like that. A lot of Western Europe isn't living like that. And that's not going to go on. That can't go on. They're not going to keep funding us so we can live like emperors while they're living like peasants. This is what I see out there, and I think this is really what's the A... the start of this problem. I looked at this, and I don't think it's just greed, because it might have been greed for Wall Street, but the average person didn't make a dollar. They lost money in this, so it really wasn't greed. It was ignorance more than anything else, but it was lethargy. There was no fear factor, and they took for granted what they had. And I think this is just totally unrealistic. And I think, unfortunately, I think the only way they're going to learn that is they're going to go through it one devil of a time, and as Steve referred to, and as I've seen with my parents, they're going to come away from this so scarred that they will carry that with them the rest of their life. I know the people in the Depression did. Most of them carried that to the grave. They saved money, which it doesn't go on now, and they didn't spend a lot of money, never frivolously. So that's just what I've noticed.
Did you were you listening to my introductory remarks on credit cards?
Yes.
I personally think that the rock will come through this credit card implosion, because clearly credit cards are the last line of defense against impoverishment, it seems to me. And of course, this will be just an extra snowball in the avalanche, which will be the implosion of debt. And it seems to me that we're looking at dead ahead, actually, at a form of impoverishment which has never been seen in history. That the extent is so much greater, and that it will have a knock-on effect worldwide, even in poor societies which depend on the wealthy ones for sustenance. So to me, it looks very much like a kind of nuclear meltdown, because obviously, you know, if all of the areas of production are grind to a halt, then they have a knock-on effect over the whole of society. I don't know whether that's how you see, you know, these Big Mac swilling people with their double Cokes and things. I mean, is this how you see it? I mean, because obviously, when we talk about this idea that you know, penury will follow in short order, it has to happen along a certain time frame, according to certain steps and elements. What do you see as being, you know, the way in which this will happen?
Well, I agree with you, and ironically, for another reason as well. One of the things I've been reading, it said, one of the advice you've been giving: get out of debt, save money, have worthwhile relationships with people you can depend upon, because in hard times, that's going to really be the currency of living. The other thing they said is take care of yourself. The best way to avoid astronomical medical bills is to avoid illness. Now, if I were trying to get someone ill, I would say to them, go to McDonald's every day and have a steady diet. So the irony is, not only are they facing impecunity because of their practices, but they're also making the situation worse. It would be as if someone, because they were depressed over this situation, lit up a cigarette, as we all know, the worst possible single thing you can do for yourself. So I agree with you. I think this is heading down the road financially, but as if we needed another shoe to drop, Mexico is probably not going to be sending us oil in about 2 or 3 years, according to a lot of the fairly knowledgeable people I've been reading, basically because of their own demand. Now, that may be postponed if the down cycle stops their use of it, but if it isn't, they're our third largest supplier. Now, if we think things are going to be tough with money, I remember the gas lines in the 70s, and that will bring everything to a halt. And Bernanke and Paulson and anyone else following them won't be able to do a darn thing about that. Everything we have revolves around fossil fuel. The reason we have the miracle economy we have and the production and everything else is fossil fuel. Everything is connected to that. And I'm looking at the third largest supplier, our next-door neighbor, Mexico, stopping the supplies to us, and I'm wondering where they're going to come from. Now, it's debatable, and I know that you don't particularly believe in the fact that we're running short of oil, or I don't know your feelings on peak oil, but...
I don't. I actually don't. I think it's a bit like global warming. I think it's a scare tactic. I think there are really plentiful supplies of oil for the foreseeable future, personally, Frank.
And Richard, you know, that's interesting, and it's something that I just keep pursuing and trying to try to figure that one out for myself. But I do know that the supply chain is very precarious. I read a book on piracy, about 3 or 4 years ago, and it wouldn't take very much. We've had a number of incidences where savages in dugout canoes with knives have boarded huge oil tankers and held the crew at bay for 20 minutes. The thing was on automatic pilot in waters where you have to navigate. Now, nothing has happened, but if one ship plugged up the mouth of one strait someplace in the world, we would have a problem. So the supply chain could be pinched. We could find out that we have some black swans in the oil industry as well. I'm not saying it will happen, Richard, but you have to admit it could happen. And if we did, we had an energy crisis on top of this financial problem, which seems insurmountable at this point. So I think there is plenty of things out there. In fact, I think literally we're building landing strips for black swans. I think that's become the national pastime in this country.
Frank, just a question here. You know, I understand the macro concepts here, which people debate endlessly, and obviously, you know, a lot of people believe that that there's going to be Armageddon in the oil industry and in the heating oil and you know, in food and everything else. But what's interesting is the average person. Well, what's going to, you see, when you talk about these things, it's always convenient because you then don't have to really discuss the individual plight of a family, say in the Midwest, and how it grinds to a halt. Do you believe that literally these people will starve to death? I mean, I'm not asking about food distribution and things like that, just an individual family. How is it that they will find that there is no way they can afford to go to a supermarket and buy food and eat? Will they literally find themselves maxed out with their credit cards, literally unable to find any more money with which to buy things at the store? I mean, and if so, how do you think that will happen? How will that play out, Frank?
I think in some cases it might go to some desperate measure like that, where somebody throws themselves on the mercy of the social services that be. Other people will, in a process, will stop eating out at McDonald's, which is a very expensive. This sounds funny, but it's a very expensive place to eat.
I'm going to interrupt you here. I'm sorry, Frank, because we're going back into these kind of rather large scale facets of how things work. I'm trying to cross that frontier now over into a situation such, you know, as you see occasionally on television, you know, with people who are individual families, how they have arrived individually at the point at which they can't afford, you know, food, and they have to go to food banks, which, by the way, are increasing dramatically in size, in case you haven't, you know, seen recent reports about this. This has not really happened. I mean, in the 1930s, families went to, you know, people went to live with their families. They eked out an existence over a number of years, which was very painful. But there was some inherent wealth. You have to remember, this country was a creditor nation in those days. Today, it's a debitor nation. We're in gigantic deficits. So that people, individuals who need to eat, how did they get them personally, do you think, to that point? What kind of a time frame, a step-by-step thing happened to them, so that now what are they going to do? How will they find food individually in this situation?
I'm not sure that I understand the question you're asking me. It isn't how they got there, right? Because we've discussed how they got there. They just insanely spent their money and didn't look to the future and didn't prepare. I think I get the gist that you're asking me, what will they do? And what I was attempting to do was say that, and I'll take it in very individually, two families I'll say. One will, through lack of any initiative, they will end up attempting to go to social services, whatever it is, the town hall, and say, you've got to feed me, or we're going to sleep here tonight, or something like that. There will be a lot of cases of desperation. The other people will do, I think, what you said. First of all, they'll use their initiative, and they will live on a lot less, and they won't eat a lot, but they'll eat. They'll take a portion, just a tiny fraction of the budget they used to spend on food, and they'll buy raw food. They'll buy products from farmers and farm stands, and they'll make their own food. There won't be any prepared food for these people. That will stop. They'll never be going to McDonald's. And I think people will do that. I think they will get by. I think they'll live with friends and neighbors and family. It'll be very difficult. Others will become wards of the state, or attempt to anyway. We have a preview of that out in the West Coast. I saw a video on YouTube the other day of a very neat tent city in a church property, on a church property. And it was startling because these weren't drug addicts or alcoholics. These were middle-class people who had lost their jobs and lost their apartments or homes. And they had a very positive attitude, and this place was very neat and orderly. And I think we're going to see a lot more charitable organizations doing desperate things like that. I'm trying to keep this on the level you asked for. I'm not trying to say this in a macro version, but I think that's what's going to happen. I think you're going to have two extremes. You're going to have the people who are going to use their ingenuity and their relationships, and they're going to get through it. There's others that simply won't do that.
When you say they're going to get through it, as opposed to what?
Starving to death.
You don't think there will be some starvation?
I think there will be, yes.
It's almost convenient. It's like when people talk about inflation, they cannot bring themselves to talk about deflation, because deflation is such an injurious concept that the playing out of deflation is absolute catastrophe, and that's why governments want to prevent it happening at all costs, and we've discussed this, you know, ad infinitum on the show. But when you talk about individuals, when you talk about people who have gradually arrived at this point, you know what has happened. I mean, they've started off by maybe being foreclosed on their home, so then they moved in with somebody else. Then they found they can't make car payments, so they've had to give up their car. Then they've had to, you know, give up the schools for the children. And then they start having to give up the more expensive type of processed foods, because the husband's now lost his job, and the wife has is losing her job, and they can't find alternative employment, or else it's so meager that it doesn't really pay. And these people have maybe three children. Now they're living with their families, and their families are having problems. And now, you know, they can't afford the food that they were able to afford before. And you're saying, I think they'll get through it. Now, you take this family with their three children that have just gone through the very steps that I've just described. Let's capture a moment in time, freeze frame a moment where now, you know, the husband and wife look at each other and say, you know, I don't know, we sold the DVD, that old DVD player. We got $50 for it last week. Anything else? What else have we got? Is there anything else you've forgotten? Did you anything upstairs? Did you see something? When you get to that point, and I think that this is going to be a point at which hundreds of thousands of families are going to arrive at, Frank. That's how bad I think it's going to get. That's the point I'm looking at right now. What happens next? You know, and you say you think they're going to get through it. My question really is how. I mean, what's going to happen to them from that point on that will enable them to survive?
I think you just hit something right on the head. You remember in my earlier remarks, I said to all the people who lived through that depression are dead. You're talking to somebody who's lived through the good years, not the bad. And I'm as guilty as anybody else although I'm trying very hard, but I'm probably as guilty as anybody else as not having a full grasp of the realization of this. I have said to people, and they think that I'm gloomy. I'm terrible. I'm the angel of death, practically, because I talk about issues that you talk about on the show. And I've said to people, even if you are doing well, if the people around you that you love and care about are in a terrible situation, you will not be happy. So having money in the bank is not going to be the panacea. I've said that. I haven't lived through this yet. And you're right. I don't have an answer for you. I don't know. I think I'm being hopeful in the fact that I'm saying that the stronger of the people in these dire situations will get through it. But I can't argue with you that the weaker probably won't. And that will lead to tremendous, not only human suffering, but social unrest. But I'm sort of learning.
But Frank, that's exactly it. You know, that's exactly what I'm here to do. This is part of what the Wake Up Call is all about, is discussing and investigating these issues, which really don't get talked about. In fact, what I'm talking to you about and what we're trying to discuss here, I have not seen. In terms of, you know, anything that has that I've seen on television or in the newspapers to discuss these really dire situations, which I foresee becoming the norm over the next 3 to 5 years, and you know, I think it's a good thing that we are discussing those now, because indeed, you know, families will arrive at a point, in my opinion, where jobs have gone, absolutely gone. I mean, you know, not even to the point at which there's any point at all in looking at the newspapers or the internet to try to find work. There just simply is none for miles and miles and miles around. And so you have these families which are literally in the process of starving to death. And I'm obviously hitting some kind of a nerve here, because even our very own engineer, Ryan, has just put up a message to me in the form of a question. Hey, Richard, what's the benefit of scaring us about global warming? Well, I take your question in the spirit in which it's meant, Ryan. As a matter of fact, funnily enough, I'm not looking at global warming. I think there isn't global warming, and I've said this many times. I think it's another scare tactic, which, along with peak oil, which is simply a non-starter. I think it's there possibly to disguise and deflect the situation from what really is, a terrible threat in our future, which is starvation, which is basically people simply not being able to generate the cash with which to exchange for food. It's something that, you know, you might all want to think about over you know, the next few months, because I think it's not going to hit everybody, of course not, but it's going to hit enough people that, as you said yourself, Frank, rightly, it's going to cause a degree of civil social unrest that will be a very great injury to the standard of living and the way of life such as we've known it in the United States. Frank, thank you very much indeed for your input. As I say, if anybody else wants to chime in here and add their 2 cents, they're more than welcome to do so. The number, again, is 888-873-4643.
Richard, just one observation.
Yeah.
You are ahead of your audience, and I think most of your audience, by a bit. You are ahead financially. I also think you're ahead in your thoughts of the outcome of this, and I think just be patient, because I think we're all learning and growing and stretching our imaginations, but you took a giant leap there. And I'm not arguing with it. I think you're correct. But it is a very difficult thing. It's one thing to intellectualize it, and it's another thing to live it. And unfortunately, I think we're going to get to live it and really learn it. But right now, we're sort of just trying to come to grips with it. I think, you know, most of the audience that's been listening for a while understands the financial fallacies of what's going on. I'm not sure that all or any of us understand the true social impact, and you know, I thank you for everything you've done, and we're getting there. I know I am personally, but it takes a while, and it's an interesting self-examination to have you ask those questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for all your commentary and your time and everything else. I'm interested in Ryan's comments here. He says, I can see the benefit about the oil scare. And then he writes money in big letters, but how will they profit by scaring us about global warming? Oh, I'm sorry. It's how will they profit by scaring us, Ryan? I thought you meant how would I, you know, that you were sort of accusing me, as it were, of scaring the world about global warming. Very simply, and that's a very good question, by the way, Frank. That is an excellent question, because at the beginning, if you remember, when global warming started to be bandied around, all of the powerful interests tried to deny its existence, and they poo-pooed it, and they said, no, this is just a passing phase, a fantasy, a fad, and etc., because all their power structure was focused on how to work, as it were, in at variance with global warming. In other words, global warming was going to queer their pitch, was going to put taxes on their profits and generally make their livelihoods a nightmare. So they were all against global warming. Well, when they realized that global warming was a fact, at least that was the given social ongoing concept, that global warming was now something you didn't even discuss because it was so real, then they immediately turned around and they retooled and they made all of their business endeavors to profit from global warming. So at that point, the whole of the discussion turned round, and all of these high-powered business interests started to vehemently support the concept of global warming, because now all of their business was geared to taking care of global warming. So then the people who, like myself, disagreed. In fact, there's so much information out there against global warming, it's not even funny anymore. But those of us who disagreed with global warming were dealt the opprobrium, which had been reserved for those who had supported it in the original stages, because now business wants you to believe that there is global warming. So the answer to your question is, how will they profit by scaring us about global warming? Indeed, just that. Oh, it's Alex. It's not Ryan. I'm sorry, Alex. I thought you were Ryan. I didn't see that Ryan had either got up and gone or that you'd been there all day. I don't know. I never know who the engineer is, obviously, unless they announce themselves. Alex, that's really how they can profit now, directly, by scaring us about global warming. And I'm here to tell you that I am quite convinced that within the next 5 years, global warming will have been discredited such and to such a point that all these business interests will have to turn around again, and as soon as they stop propounding the existence of global warming, it will just die a natural death, and we'll go back to the ongoing movement towards what so many scientists have described as the up-and-coming ice age, which is pockmarked, you know, like bear market rallies, with periods of warming, which, by the way, ended several years ago, and the temperatures have been getting colder since then, notwithstanding this terrible winter that the north of the United States has suffered in Canada. But that's another story for another day. Thank you for your input there, Alex. It's been interesting to deal with. A question, or rather an email from Hugh Thomas, who says, dear Richard, a riveting refrain and one with no small ring of moral imperative in many of your commentaries on the balance sheet fictions that hold hostage any honest appraisal of our current situation, is that the questionable paper therein should be written down, thence allowing a painful but responsible return to conditions where credit and investment would feed economic goals worthy of the risks they entail. Could you, within the time and format that is your show, lay out the succession of actions that would constitute such a move and what the immediate and long-term effects might look like? As always, I eagerly look forward to your weekly classes of the dismal science, otherwise known as economics, for those of you not aware of same, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks yet again, Hugh. Well, Hugh, I can't lay it out. I mean, I could invent, as it were, a timeline for this. But we are traveling down a road which is so untraveled and quite without any pointers to where we should be going next, that it would be really it would be dishonest of me to say that I have really a concept in my mind as to how this will play out or would play out. You see, the problem is that you cannot cure an economy with the medicine which was exactly the same as what caused the problem in the first place, which, as I always say, which is money. What you have to do when you reach a situation in a society, which, after all, you know, is a human society and has been in our experience for, you know, thousands of years, when you reach a point of boom, at the end of a boom in the kind of society that we live in, the only way to make it go away quickly is to allow it to bust as quickly as possible. It really doesn't work any other way. And I hate to say this, but I always find the analogy of the addict to be the most interesting, because the hardest time to cure an addict is when the addict is still under the influence and has further to go on the downside. You know, if you go to an addict and say, well, I think you really shouldn't be doing this, you really ought to stop, they're going to laugh at you, or at best they're going to pretend they'll do what you say and then go on doing the same thing. It's only when you let them go to the point of absolute despair with their addiction that they turn around and will agree to go to rehab or do the things they have to do. You only got to look at the high-profile film stars and public figures that go in and out and in and out of rehab like a revolving door to realize that they were never really ready for it in the first place. And the trouble with what's happening today is that if you allow people with their credit cards to get more credit, to buy more things, if you encourage people through these programs, these bailout programs, to simply extend the problem that they all got themselves into, all that will happen, and this is what happened, by the way, in the 1930s, and we talked about this with Bert Folsom on Monday, all that will really happen is that it will take much, much longer for the problem to play itself out. And the problem has to play itself out. It has to. There is no way in which the problem can sort of suddenly go away. It's not like the weather. You can't just stand, you know, under a tree and say, well, the rain will we're in a tropical rainstorm here. It will end in about 10 minutes. The sun will come out and we can continue on our merry way. It doesn't happen like that in economies. And the problem with democracy is democracy doesn't accept that. Democracy requires that politicians are as inventive as possible in finding not solutions, but ways in which to stay in power. And that, of course, involves bailouts that come to the ignorant, the people that don't understand the consequences of them. And basically, they offer the worst medicine at the worst possible time. In other words, it won't work. And you will find that it doesn't work. And this has nothing to do with being pessimistic or optimistic. This is just bare factual reality as evidenced by historical context. So, you know, it's every time you see these bailouts being voted on and these politicians posturing, you know, about what should be done and what shouldn't be done and can and can't be done, you should cringe, because they will be done, because the politicians will discover very quickly that it is in their best interests, if they want to stay in power, to vote for all these programs. And I am here to tell you that they will not work. There is no possible way in which these kind of programs can produce the desired effect. So I can tell you right now that we need to talk much more about how we as a community, as beings living in a toxic environment, can find a way around it. And I am afraid that brings me back to this whole idea of, you know, leaving altogether. And if you remember in my last show, I said that if anybody wanted to discuss the listeners' comments about, you know, abandoning one's country, which has done one so much good, you're welcome to call in and talk about that. Nobody has done that. But I don't personally think that's relevant to our situation right now. I'm talking to you, ladies and gentlemen, as my listeners on the wake-up call, about matters that pertain to you personally. How what is going to happen in the world will affect you, what you should do about it for your own best interests, and, of course, the interests of the people around you, whether they're your families or your friends. In many cases, if they're your friends, you will tell them about the things that you hear. You can't maybe do much about them, but you can talk to them. And that's what we're going to try to do. And we are going to, obviously, we're going to have to take this in a much more serious and far-reaching context than I had necessarily thought we would have. I mean, I never thought we'd see these bailouts. Why would I? We never had them before. It never occurred to me that the people in power should have that much irresponsibility to actually propose these kinds of things. But they have, and so we have to deal with them. And it won't be pretty. And have a wonderful weekend, everybody. It's time's up, and we shall be back on Monday, 1 p.m., for another edition of Wake Up Call. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.